outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of Bavada's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Journey.
You know, you can't sling freedom all over the place and charge for it, or even sell it to advertisers. That's why the God Journey is commercial-free, Patreon-free, and begging-free. I get emails almost every week, people who want to buy advertising on the God Journey and how we're wasting our audience and all that good stuff. And honestly, just don't need it, not charging for it. It's free. If you hate it, you don't even have to listen to it. You're not paying for it. So there we go. Anyway, let me invite you into a two-part conversation. I'll be honest, I didn't plan it that way. We were going to do a one-parter and just have a conversation, but it was so rich and went on so long that ended up filling two podcasts. So I'm going to air the first one today. The second one will air a week from today, next Friday, because we're doing something a bit different on Tuesdays. It began with a book that Sarah and I started reading while I was coming back from Denver, driving in our little RV. Sarah was driving, actually, and I started reading this book to her that I've heard a lot about and read some things about and wasn't excited about reading and love the title, but finally got to it on that drive. And the book is called White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. The author is Robin DiAngelo, and it's gotten to be fairly well-known, bestseller lists, all kinds of things. So a white woman talks to white people about racism and why it's awkward for us to talk about it. I don't love the title for reasons that will come up in the podcast, but I do love the content. There's so much in it that shook my world, especially the things I've been through in the last few years. It just kind of helped me have a place to process some more of the growth that's going on in my life. And as I was reading through the whole book and finished it last week, I thought, I really want to talk to Arnita Taylor about this. Arnita Taylor is my friend. She's a woman who lives outside Dallas, Texas. And she was my co-author along with Bob Prater on A Language of Healing for a Polarized Nation. And I know Arnita doesn't need to read this book and didn't read all of it, but I wanted to process some of the thoughts that I had with her, and she wanted to do that with me. So we decided to do a podcast about it, and as I said, it turned into two. So without further ado, here's my friend Arnita Taylor and our discussion about white fragility and how we can find a better way to communicate about the issues that divide us. Arnita, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Good morning.
We thought we'd talk about a book that I got reading recently and thought, man, it'd be fun to kind of let you take us through it. I want to ask you a question, though, before I might actually turn over this podcast to Arnita, and I'm going to let her run the conversation however she wants to take me through this experience of white fragility and how we talk about it in our culture. I want to ask you, with all that's happened in the last few weeks, where's your heart in all this? Are you more hopeful that something's going to change? Are you kind of sitting back looking and saying, man, I hope so, but I'm not sure yet? I mean, what's going on inside you, if you don't mind?
Well, we have had some very distinct changes in some policies and some laws and things like that. But as far as personal people and people in my personal life, I'm just not sure. I think everybody's kind of in an emotional upheaval right now. And I'm more concerned with how they're going to walk it out, you know, to be more than a social media post, more than an I'm sorry, or more than I feel so bad. I'm kind of looking for that in the people that I do life with. So it'll be interesting. I do think the needle is moving. And so I'm grateful for the needle moving, but, you don't want to forebode joy, but you don't want to have too much and go, and be deflated again. But I do think that we're going in the right direction. And I'm just grateful for all the people who are having conversations about race oriented topics that have never had them before. So.
Yeah, me too. I'm excited about that as well. Well, the book is White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism, the author Robin J. DiAngelo. Arnita, I'm just going to turn it over to you. And I sent you some of the things that impacted me from this book. And where do you want to go? Where do you want to go with this conversation?
You know, I think we're just going to go with some of the things that impacted you. It's very interesting. Let me tell you, we've had this talk, but just for our listeners, several people referred me to white fragility. And I always kind of laugh and give a little snicker, kind of like I did with you. Yep. And I wasn't being funny or smart. I was just kind of going, well, you know, Dr. DiAngelo probably didn't write that book for me. But it's just neat that so many people were picking the book up. And so I think it gives a lot of hope and verbiage to people who want to talk to maybe white people who haven't, but I don't have that problem. I'm very free in talking to people. As you see, I wrote a book about some things. So I love that in White Fragility, Dr. D'Angelo is a little bit different. I'm a leadership coach, so we go from theory to practice. She kind of reversed that. She went from practice to theory. So she took what she had done corporately and professionally for many years and brought it back to theory. And it is one good thing. So we're going to talk about it a little bit. I love that that book is out there for people to start to educate themselves, because I do think it's a great place to start. But I think it's probably a hard place to start for most people, because most people who will pick up her book will not think they're racist at all. And so that's kind of a hard book to swallow when you don't think you're racist at all. But we'll just go with one of the things that you thought was so interesting about the book. And I'll just kind of ask you the question. So why do white people, for the most part, not view themselves in racial terms?
She brought that up in the first chapter, and I was reading it to Sarah while we were driving back from Denver, actually, in our little RV that we got stopped for drugs at one point, thinking we were carrying drugs on the way. This is on the way back. And she talked about white people generally don't think of themselves as a race. And I'm going, that's true. That's true of me. I don't think about it. And I think partly why is because there's so many different versions of white. You've got Italian Americans, you've got Latinos, you've got so many people that we more identify, I think, with our country of origin or our where we came from if we immigrated to the States, or we more think of diversity in that way, I think, as white people. And I don't think of a monolithic Caucasian white race. I don't live my life in swimming in that soup, because I do live my life swimming in it, but I'm not aware of it as much until reading something like this. And I'll go, you know what? I really have not thought of myself racially. I think of my Black friends racially. I think of my Latino friends ethnically. I think of other people having different races, but it's not always easy to pick up on the one you are, particularly if it's the predominant, world I live in.
Right. And I think that thank you for saying that. I think she made that very, very clear. It's funny. We have a language of feeling discussion group. And I threw out a question last week, not saying that I was going to have a conversation with you. I just kind of wanted to throw it out there. And I asked the question, what does it mean to be white in America? And it was so interesting. We got all kinds of responses. The one thing that I noticed is we didn't have a lot of responses from white males. We had a lot of white women, but we had probably two or three white males who had been previously very vocal in the group. And on this question, it was kind of crickets. But here's some of our the responses we got. Okay. To be white in America is privileged. I know that's the word that's a trigger, but Dr. D'Angelo talks about it a lot. Free. You define everything. Gatekeepers. I thought that was interesting. The center or the standard. Things are centered around your whiteness. Belonging. American, even. It's funny how sometimes when people are thinking American, they're thinking white American. Not having to think about race was actually one of the things that people responded to. Not having to have a double consciousness, meaning you don't have to navigate two different realities at the same time. One person said normal. Being white is just normal. Not having to say I'm sorry. That was very interesting. Whiteness was safe. And whiteness was you're innocent until you're proven guilty. And I thought that was just a real little interesting little Facebook poll that I took within our group of people who are talking, having these kind of conversations. And so I understand why you have answered the way that you've answered. It is true that in America, white men occupy the highest positions of race and gender hierarchy. Thus, you have the power to define your own reality and that of others. This reality does not only include whose experiences are valid, but whose are fundamentally valid. How would you address the power that you've been given to speak to someone's validity and their experiences? That's a tall order.
I think it's horrible. I mean, I don't think of it. Yeah, I don't think of it that way. And that's part of the, you say, what is it to grow up white in America? You kind of think and say, man, I just, it's something I haven't processed until more recently in my life, because I never thought of myself as white. I just think of myself as an American, and I don't think of myself as validating or not validating people, but I know the white race does. I know that overall that becomes true. But it's not something I've ever thought about. It's not something I've ever tried to intentionally do or not do. I think that's what's hard when talking about why it's hard to talk about racism. I think that's why. It's because we don't think we're swimming in a racist reality, a racial reality. We just don't think about it.
Gotcha. And you know, the interesting part of that is we've written a book on how to have conversations around healing, but certainly we can't repair if we can't talk about it. And if we can't talk about it in some level of common ground, as you would say, just understanding we do operate in a racial reality in America, whether people realize it or acknowledge it or not, there is a white centeredness in America. And so I can see how the conversations don't happen across racial lines because they're hard, which is kind of where she goes in the book. Another concept that she talks about in the book is how individualism supports a racist society. And this is how she says it. Individualism claims that there are no intrinsic barriers to individual success and that failure is not a consequence of social structures that comes from individual character. Now, I think there's so much truth to that statement, but could you tell me how you feel about the individualism that she's talking about?
Yeah, I love the concept of individualism in the sense that each of us has responsibility for our own lives and to make the best choices we can to move forward in the thing. What interested me from her writing was how much just that thought of individualism removes the sense of class responsibility. It removes the sense that some of us in our individual choices have better choices than others who don't have the same options that we have. And then how individually we just say, well, it's a matter of, you know, if you work hard and you achieve and you can point to, like I know often happens in my community, we often point to those black people who have great success and they came from the ghetto or they came from some very difficult place and they say, see, they made it. So it's just a matter of hard work and diligence. And I think what she opens up is when you default to that, you ignore the realities that determine how successful your hard work can make you, or how much is already aligned against you to make that way forward. And when you just default to individualism, then you don't have to look at the harder choices I think we have to make as a society to say, how do we level the playing field so that everyone has not just in ideal equal opportunity, but that is in fact true regardless of what race you are. And so her thought about this individualism is it just takes us out of the racial discussion, because all we do is say, we just talk about our own and no, I've never discriminated against anybody. I've never passed any laws against black people. I've never denied a mortgage to somebody who wants to live in a white community. I've never. So I can exempt myself from the larger realities of what this society looks like. And so the collectivism and the sense of community for white people to have, even people like us, me, who believe in real individual value and individual hard work and responsibility, I believe in all that. At the same time, I've got to realize that some of our ways of defending that take away from our responsibility to alter society at a larger level.
Absolutely. It takes away from the ability to certainly bring in a different point of view there, just to see another person's perspective. You know, there's this thing called bootstraps, and you'll hear people say, just pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. Well, what if I didn't have boots or straps to start
with? Right. Wow.
So yeah. It's hard for me to pull myself up from them when I have not had them. And so it's an exercise in empathy and understanding if you care to get in that space. And what I find is a lot of people just don't care to get in that space. There's a moral part of them that kind of wants to get in that space, but there's always cognitive dissonance, I guess we could say, to help them kind of like, oh, I don't know if I really want to go there. It's a moral issue. It's not a moral issue. So thanks for saying that.
I don't think we like looking at suffering and feeling responsible for it. A friend invited me to go to a room full of millionaires, and some guy was lecturing them from New York about their wealth. And he asked them, one of the first questions he asked was, do any of you feel uncomfortable with the wealth you have in view that other people don't have it? anybody feel uncomfortable? And not a hand went up in the room. I just went, really? Nobody's uncomfortable with what wealth you have? And what they said was, why aren't you uncomfortable? And everybody answered, I worked hard for mine. I worked hard for mine. I worked hard for mine. Well, I grew up on a farm. I've watched farm workers on my dad's farm work harder than I ever did. And they didn't get the same advancement that we got. So I'm looking at just hard work alone is, like you say, if you don't have boots or straps, how are you going to pull yourself up? And yet I think people don't want to look at that. And they don't want to look at need without being able to say, well, if they would just do X, Y, or Z, they wouldn't be there. That way I can kind of wash my hands of feeling discomforted by the fact that I might have more advantages or I might have better opportunities than other people do.
You know, I think it's interesting that you brought up the G word, guilt, because often when we embark in these type of conversations, I think people, a lot of white people withdraw from this type of conversation because they start to feel white guilt. I really do believe that. And I think in general, guilt is such an empty emotion. It's such an emotion to stop you from doing something or going forward in general. So how would you address the white guilt piece of being able in fragility and being able to have these conversations?
Well, I'm a Jesus guy, and I think that guilt and shame was removed at the cross for us. And I think one of the great values of having shame and guilt removed is then you really get to sit in your problem, your weakness, your brokenness, your failures, and be able to assess it, not from, I feel bad, I want to hide, I don't want to feel bad, but, okay, what do I need to do differently? How do I need to think differently? How do I need to act differently? So I want to encourage people who react. I mean, think white fragility. It's not my favorite term. I know it's the title of the book. And fragility is also used a lot for kind of snowflake kind of people who can't be in any setting where everybody doesn't totally agree with what they think. And so they're very fragile. And she doesn't describe white fragility as being fragile in that sense. It's a very aggressive kind of holding the status quo. So we don't have to think or change or deal with the priority, privilege, whatever that we might have. And so it really is what she calls it, a form of bullying, which I think, wow, yeah. I never would have thought of this. I think fragility is just a really bad term to wrap our heads around what she's trying to say. So I kind of wish she'd found a better term, I guess, because I really agree that when you bring up racial things, and I don't know if it's just guilt. I know for some, it's just tired. We feel like we've been at this since the 60s. Surely we've fixed this by now. Civil rights legislation, affirmative action. Surely we're an equal society now. And there's part of that. There's just that fatigue of, I don't want to address this again. And yeah. And when you're not the oppressed bunch from that, it's easy to ignore the ramifications. Then we have something like George Floyd, and now we can't ignore it anymore. We're seeing statistics that say, wow, blacks are incredibly disadvantaged economically and in the perceptions of who's guilty, who's innocent in the eyes of some people who are in law enforcement. And so now you've got to take a step back and go, okay, there is a problem. We do have to talk about it. And I even know, I've never worked in an office situation, but I know when guys and ladies have to go to sexual harassment training or diversity training, there's this mockery of it, this roll of the eyes. Surely we're past it by now, which is what, I mean, Robin DiAngelo, that's how she started as a trainer for diversity stuff. And she sees that, says that, don't want to talk about it, don't want to get into it. And I want to say to white, we've got to. If we don't talk about it, things won't change. And if things won't change, our society's hard-pressed to survive.
It's true. And, you know, the interesting part of that is you talk about conversation fatigue about it. The thing that I think of as an African-American is if you're tired of talking about it, imagine how tired I am of living it.
I know.
Imagine. If you can even put your head in that space, if you're tired of talking about it, I'm tired of being on the back, on the receiving end of it. And so none of us can get fatigued at talking about it. We have to go through it because the problems, we are not in a post-racial America, as we can see now. And we have to go forward. It's going to get messy before it gets better, but it can be better. And so I love that. Well, let's talk about the word white fragility, since you brought it up as a form of bullying. I would agree with Dr. DiAngelo on that statement. And I want to unpack that a little bit with you. White fragility emerges whenever problems with race are mentioned. And it's so often met with silence or defensiveness or argumentation or certitude or other forms of pushback. Now, we have a little social media group discussion group, and I see this all the time. But what I see often is the people who respond most aggressively or assertively are not even people who've lived in brown skin. And that just sends me over the top. So how do we get past bringing up a small racial issue, just something really subtle, and people kind of shutting you out? I don't want to talk about that. We don't talk like that over here. No, you know, and we get that all the time. So how do we work past some of that fragility?
I get that too, honestly. I've done some blogs on this. I've done some, even the book coming out. I've got people telling me, why do you have to bring this up now? I don't like political Wayne. I like Jesus Wayne. Let's go back to that stuff. I've got other people write saying, Wayne, thank you. Thank you for helping us deal with this. Thank you for walking us through this. I think you just have to keep bringing it up. I mean, my friendship with you over the last 2 years and Michael, it's made me exhausted for you. And you don't wear me out with what you share with me about your pain. You have opened my eyes to the way the world treats you that's very different. Now, I grew up in California, so I grew up in the Central Valley. Not a lot of African-Americans in the Central Valley. Not a lot of overt racism in this area. We didn't have segregated schools. We haven't done through any of that. So I'm in the South. I get much more how much this overlays almost everything in the culture. I think in California, it's not that it's not here. It's just way more subtle. It's just way more subtle how white people kind of always hang together, how Mexicans hang together, how African-Americans hang together. And there isn't a lot of cross experiencing life with each other. The way you've let me into your life, I think has really helped me see how racism, we're going to say white fragility, how much that is impacting people I care about. And so now, no, I don't want to be silent about it. I don't care if I lose readers on my blog or people get tired of, oh, you haven't Arnita on the podcast yet. You're going to talk about race again. I'm just going to, yeah.
Again, that girl again.
I'm going to, and we're going to do it because I think people are waking up. I see people who look like me are now asking different questions than they were asking. And they're not the argumentative, put it off, devaluate, you know, if somebody's saying, you know, I experienced a race thing. I've had people just say, how do we know what happened to George Floyd was a racist thing? What if it's just, uncooperative, and they'd have done the same thing to a white guy? I said, well, show me the video. If you've got a video of him treating a white guy like that, show me that. But how can we say it's not race when it keeps happening, when the names of black people who are killed by racist police officers don't continue to impact us? But I think one of the ways to get in white fragility, you and I had this discussion a lot, is privilege a great word to use in the white community if you want to have a conversation about race? And you say, yeah, man, we need to own it. We need to do it. I'm going, yeah. You know what? It shuts so many conversations off. I just try and get people to say, don't you see that you have an advantage? And I said to someone the other day who was just saying, you know, I think we're equal in America. And I just looked at him. I said, let me ask you a question. And this is a guy that was at the Civil Rights March with Martin Luther King Jr. in the 1960s in Selma, Alabama. So I said, do you think your life would be different if you'd been born with brown skin than white skin? He goes, oh, absolutely.
And I'm going, da, da, da.
That's all we're talking about.
That's all we're talking about.
He was fighting me until I just said, don't you think it's different? The opportunities you've had in your life, and this guy's older, he's in his senior years. He goes, oh, gosh, everything would have been different. I said, that's the point. The point is we're not going to grovel and say, oh, we're going to talk about racism all the time because it's such a horrible thing. The point is there's a problem. We got to find a way to address it because most of us don't. If we actually stop and think about it, I don't think someone having brown skin is less human, less loved by God, less anything.
Of course not.
But the way society acts, the way we've, and some of that is overtly racist. And I'll say I think some of it's also commercial. Right? It's marketing. I've got a friend in Sweden who wants to write and publish a book in Sweden. You publish a book in Swedish in Sweden, you may sell 300 or 400 copies. The opportunity to sell books in Sweden is not the same as being born in the U.S. market. I'm a white guy in a U.S. market. That's the predominant buying public. Whatever I do, and it doesn't have to be overtly against black or brown people. It just is the commercialism of industry is find the biggest market and sell to it all that you can.
I think a lot of it is commercialization, but I think a lot of it is just socialization. We are socialized very differently in the same country.
Agreed.
We are just socialized differently. You know, I remember being on a team where I was the only minority, and I just was always retaliated against because I just wasn't socialized that way. So, for instance, I don't want to come to work in skinny jeans and something else because I got too much to put up in it, and B, I just, you know, jeans ain't my thing. So, but why do you retaliate with me on how I've been socialized? You know, the very thing that you talked about your friend responding so violently until you ask him a question, that's white fragility. You know, I see people argue or just want to debate all the time stuff that's just kind of obvious if you would sit back and think about it. Nobody's here to make you feel a certain kind of way. We're just saying, hey, when it's kind of like with people touching my hair. Like I'll always say, hey, don't make jokes about my hair. Don't touch my hair. I don't do that to you. You may be looking like a mess, but I don't come up and tell you, hey, your hair is crazy and let me touch it and help you. And so it's just thinking through some of the things. Why do you get so upset about a Black person talking about race? I don't understand why the upsetting is so much, but that's what white fragility is about. So I'll keep going. You know, another thing that she brings out in the book, and we've kind of talked about this, you know, you and I and me, you and Bob, we got hung up about 2 hours on the word privilege. So we won't recant that for them. I think you remember, but it is skin privilege for all those people who are really struggling with privilege. Just call it skin privilege. So that you can understand that's really what it is, because your friend understood it once you put it in that context. And if that's what it takes, I'm all for it. There are so many different definitions of racism. And I can remember when we were writing A Language of Healing, it's probably captioned as the dreaded R word. Because, man, y'all did not want to put racism, the word racism in there. And I was like, we got to talk about racism. So you're right. There's lots of different definitions of racism. But Dr. D'Angelo says people, most white people, this is very key, define racism as intentional acts of racial discrimination committed by immoral individuals. That's so interesting. I do think that she's correct in that.
Oh, I would say 90% of white people would define racism that way. So when you start talking about racism, they're going, that's not me. I'm not that person. I haven't done anything. I'm not wanting to do anything. And yeah, so when you, that's part of the problem of talking about anything. When you switch the term so that white people use racism that way, and the Black community is using racism as, no, it's just a system weighted against us. It's all the ways that that happens, intentionally or unintentionally. It doesn't matter. It's just, we're still fighting this because of the color of our skin. We're fighting an uphill battle that you don't fight.
Yeah.
This is where terms, I think, fail us so much. We've got to find those terms that invite people into a discussion of change rather than I got to force my term on them, because that that's a fight that's, in the end of the day, I don't think it's worth fighting. Yeah. So whether you want to call it racist or you want to call it, I don't even know what the term would be, but just to be able to recognize the problem for what it is and then make the corrections that need to be made, whether it's a heart correction, the way I view people, or whether it's the way our society systemically treats them. Because I think even now in the white community, when you talk about systemic racism, most of them are thinking, well, that's laws and things in the government. And they're going, we don't have those laws. And I'm going, that's not what they mean by systemic. It doesn't mean that it's in the laws. It means it's in the psyche of people and the way we treat each other. It's two qualified candidates sitting in front of someone who hires, and one's got dreadlocks and one's got, and one fits into the corporate culture better, who may not be more qualified. That's systemic racism right there. It's not in a rule. It's not in anything other than we prefer people of our own ilk. And we find like the wrestler who had dreadlocks, they make him cut it off before he has to wrestle because that's not the way we wear our hair in this society. That's that cultural, you know, differences that we've been raised in, that one values one thing, one values another. But the fact is, if you're white, yours gets priority because there's more of you.
Matter of fact, if you're white, yours is right. is really what that communicates. And everybody else's is wrong because this country is centered around whiteness, which is why we will always have this issue until we start breaking down those systems and changing it from the top down. That's so important. You know, I recommend to people hiring people, don't, you know, put two resumes right in front of yourself and just look at the performance. Cover up everything else and just look at the performance and see if you would make the same decision. Because by the time you go through looking them up and finding their pictures and all that, you know, have somebody remove that before it gets to you. Because I bet you your hiring practices would change, but that's just one element of
it is. But then you think of your corporate image, you don't think of as a racial thing, but it is. For many corporations, it's very racial.
Of course it is.
And
of course it is. And the funny thing about that side of it is you can have empirical data. There's a lot of statistics as to the percentages of minorities you have in your companies and on your team. That's not something that's elusive. That's not nuanced.
That is
empirical. We can know that. And people still argue that. No, my team is diverse. And I'm like, oh, it is. And you have like 5% people out of 100. It's not diverse. You have probably what you have put on staff as a token, but we can't go with that word either. But in a language of healing, I think it's interesting that we talked about aversive racism on page 184. And aversive racism is not what people think. You know, it's not people using racial slurs and saying you can't drink after me or you can't come to my house. But at the end of the day, some people just don't have a positive attitude or mentality toward people of color, black or brown people. And that's what makes aversive racism so damaging. I think she says, what does Dr. D'Angelo say? She says the white progressives, is this when she's talking about white progressives or people who are just I call them non-racial people. You just don't say anything. And she says that white progressives hurt the cause of debunking racism more than anyone. So I thought that was interesting.
It is very interesting. Yeah. And I think the same thing's true right now in the discussion we're having in our country. It's the extremes on either side, whether it's extremes on the right or the extremes on the left, who take a real problem and then try and make it something worse than it is. Then you get all the other people just turned off by, well, it's not that. And that's why we got to stay in the middle where we're really talking about what's true and what's right and not on the extremes of rhetoric that cause other people to turn off whose help we need in this process of change. The vast difference between what we verbally tell our children and all other ways we train them into the racial norms of our culture. We grew up in Sunday school singing red and yellow, black and white, they are precious in his sight. And so you think you're like that aversive thing that I'm not. But as you grow up, I mean, a lot of times it was the Mexican kids in front of the bathroom smoking made it dangerous to go in there in high school. And so you get an aversion to that kind of thing. Or you see all the black mugshots of this burglar that was arrested in the paper. And they often show, there's record, they show more black mugshots than they show white mugshots, even though there's more white people arrested for crime. And so those are some of the ways we've been enculturated into being fearful about, you know, being in a black neighborhood, or if more than 30% of a neighborhood becomes black, the whites move out. Those kinds of statistics is that same reality of, I just don't see them as people with the same hopes and dreams and desires I have. I saw a preacher last week and he said, you know, race is arbitrary. And on the surface of that, it seems a little bit offensive, like, what? No, it's not. It's real. But the fact is, the fact that you have browner skin than I do doesn't make you any different a person. No genetic makeup, nothing. It's all enculturated the way we've taken our racial differences and defined people, or like you said, validated or invalidated people based on the color of their skin.
Yeah. You know, I love that you brought up the difference between what we verbally tell our children and what we're actually doing to socialize them differently. Just the other day, Michael, my poor Michael, you know, you walked with Michael when you were here.
I do. I love
him. He was walking in our neighborhood because he walks like crazy. He was walking and he noticed this little girl start running and screaming to find her mom. And she was saying, there's a black man in the neighborhood. There's a black man in the neighborhood. And she was probably under 5.
Wow.
And I thought, well, I know what she's being taught in her home. Now, if I sit down with her mom, I don't know her family. I don't know him from Adam. But if I sit down with her family, they would probably say, no, we don't teach her to be scared of Black people. We don't teach her to do that. They would categorically deny that. But why would one little girl see one man in a neighborhood walking and run screaming to find her mom? It's that kind of thing. It's what we posit versus what we do. I'll have women come to me sometime and go, you know, I want my kids to have a diverse world. And I'm like, do you have a diverse friend set? You know, do you do that? That has to be modeled for children. And I don't think we're honest enough with how differently we are socialized. And it goes back to school. Like you said, we're very differently socialized in all facets of school. But particularly by the time you get to middle school and high school, you are normally doing people with who are like you most of the time, unless you really work hard against
That's it. Why we said in our book, you've got to really choose to have relationships beyond your in-group, whatever you consider, because it's just more comfortable to hang with people we think who look like us, but it's a lot more fun to hang with people who don't. It's a lot more fun to experience a broader sense of culture and experience. And even here, I mean, that's what's changed my life. I said this week in a video cast that we did earlier, I can tell when I'm in a discussion about race with someone that has friends outside their race, both Black and white. It's a very different conversation. One's theoretical. And it's excuses and argumentation. And the other one is very empathetic because they have friends who have dealt with the very things they wish were no longer in our culture, but they have friends who deal with it. So then they're more able to step back and say, okay, we got to then.
Right. And we talk so much about proximity in our book. You know, this changes when you have proximity to people who are different. It changes when it becomes personal. Your fragility has to go out of the window once you have a friend who's told you this so many times that, do you not love your friend? Do you not trust your friend? Is your friend making this up? More than likely not. But it just softens you once you hear it so many times by someone you're in close proximity with.
That's where the media doesn't serve us well, because we see somebody talking and they'll go, oh, I don't know. That's not really true, because you don't know anybody for whom that's true. So you can disregard it so easily. And it does take those relational connections, one person, one relationship at a time. That's how the world changes.
It does. And you know, and it's never that we don't know that there's systemic racism. We do. But the part that we control is our part of it, which is we have to get in here and talk with different people and build relationships differently so you can debunk your own stereotypes and stop discrimination. And it'll all channel a little bit differently. But we know that that is all of what needs to be reformed is great, is mighty. So we'll have to all work together. I want to talk about, she talks about a little bit about the difference between intentions and effect. Now, I always call this intentions versus impact. So let's talk about that a little bit.
That's where we get around the whole white fragility thing, honestly. Because, again, if racism is discriminatory acts by immoral people, then everybody wants to defend themselves. If we can just say, look, the result of my actions or the result of my actions in the wider community that I live in is to repress, oppress, harm people I care about. Now I get to deal with it. Not am I a bad person with bad intentions, but simply is the impact I'm having hurtful to other people? And if it's hurtful to other people, I love this. I shared it when we were in the book, Nelson Mandela saying, we're not free until we're all free. It's not a matter of putting whites under oppression to set Blacks free. It's that we all need to be free. We all need to have the same opportunity. We need to treat each other with respect and kindness and love and empathy. We need to celebrate this great diversity that God's created in the world. And that's the challenge. And you can talk about it. That's why I think Christians, it's so easy to talk about or sing red and yellow, black and white. And it's a different thing to actually live the things we're talking about, to open up your life, to let other people into it. And that's where I hope people who listen to this. And I know I had one sermon. I know I still said to you one time, I don't think I ever recall hearing a sermon on racism. And then I remembered one after we had that talk. It was back in the day, I was on staff at a church, and we had a talk about how we don't always mix well, blah, blah, blah. And there was one black couple in this church of about 500 people. And the people afterwards told me, then they had about 500 dinner invitations the next week. And then a month later, none. It was like, okay, we got to do something to prove we're not. And then once you do, they didn't engage relationships anymore. They got a dinner invite out of it. And that's so much of what I think we do when some of this stuff's exposed. We'll do a thing, That doesn't really change anything. It just makes us feel better about what we haven't been doing.
Yeah, it's kind of reactive. And that's kind of what, when you ask me how I feel about being hopeful, you know, diversity is one part. Inclusion is the other part, or globalization is the other part. And what are you doing to include that person or that mindset or that difference into your everyday life? In one time, one dinner, one coffee, that's a start. I don't want anyone to hear me not to say.
Yeah, don't not do that. Yeah.
Oh, don't not do that.
Right.
But let's go beyond that and go farther. I want to go back to something you said about, you know, in intentions and impact or effect, as she says it. Why is it that if I tell you it's hurtful, I still get a fragile response? Sometimes. From some people.
Oh, I think I do a lot. I think that's cross-racially, too. I mean, you tell white people, if I feel something, hey, you know, that what you did to me there hurts. Well, I didn't mean it. I didn't. And immediately they'll go on defensive thing because, and if they really didn't mean it, I like hearing it. If I say, you know, you said something really hurtful to me and they go, oh gosh, that's not what I meant at all. What I meant was this. I'm okay hearing that because I say, okay, I misunderstood you. Good. No harm, no foul. But when you actually, when the hurt is empirical, I mean, it really is definable, visible, seeable. I think people, particularly Christian people, they so want to prove they're the good guy. That they just can't sit back and say, I made a mistake. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was wrong.
And I, just as a human being, I knew up until my 40s, saying I'm sorry to anything was almost impossible for me to do. I'd rather defend myself. I didn't want people to think that I would have done that to them. And now it's very easy to say, oh my gosh, my bad. I'm sorry. Let's fix it. What can I do to help you fix it? But I think that's just the fragile ego that a lot of us live with. It's just we can't bear to think we failed somebody, anybody, so we keep pretending we don't. It's the parent keeps pretending to be the perfect parent when the children knows they're not. And the parent who really gets honor from kids is the one that owns their mistakes and failures, not the one who tries to cover them up. It's all, when you apologize to a kid, you know what? I misunderstood. I got angry. My bad. I shouldn't treat you that way. You don't lose the respect of your kids. You gain it.
You gain it. Yeah.
And the same way, what you're talking about here, if somebody's coming to me saying what you said was hurtful, particularly if it's somebody outside my in-group, so like I have no idea what you're talking about, my next thing is going to be, okay, first of all, I'm sorry, but second of all, teach me. Teach me. Yeah. What did that do? Why did that hurt you? What did I say? I'm not sure I know what I said. I wish I did, but I don't. Yeah. So help me.
I love that.
Okay, let me break it off right there. Yeah, we kept going. Wasn't planning on it, but man, just really enjoyed the time. Really get into some stuff in the next one about action steps, a specific movie that everyone loves. But what are the racist undertones of that movie, and how did we miss those when we watched it? So we're going to talk about some of that next week right here on The God Journey. Hope you can join us.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.